Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons. As you can see, I took out the intro, hope everybody had a great holiday weekend. And I'm here always with Sherry Payne. Sherry, how are you?
Oh, hanging in there. How about you, Jason?
I'm doing okay. We've had some really awesome weather up here in the Northwest. Have you been out to enjoy it? I haven't, unfortunately.
No, I haven't. I don't want to get burned. I'm trying to stay away from the sun, so I'm just kind of staying away from there. Trying to stay out of much of the sun and turn on the air conditioning, and that's where I'm at.
Well, I do what I normally do, which is just sleep on the weekends. I feel like I'm almost cheating myself because I'm not enjoying the sun, but I guess that's the way life is. You need sleep.
Yeah. Well, you're almost, you're not graveyard, but yeah, I see what you're saying, and that's what shift I'm at. The natural shift is staying up late at night and kind of sleeping in the morning, but you have some sleep issues going on here and there.
Yeah, why can't I just have like a morning job? See, the problem is I work super late at night and I'm a morning person. So,
are you really? Seriously?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm. I go to bed at 3 a.m. and I'm usually wake up at like 6. It's crazy.
Oh my gosh! Wow, you're a morning person. I'm not a morning person. The only reason why I have to be a morning person is because I have to get up and run, or I've got a show to do, and, you know, I have to get up early. But other than that, I'm just not a morning person. I'm not the crack of dawn kind of gal, you know. It's just like my quiet time is at night, so.
I'm like a homo sapien rooster.
I'm
the crack of dawn.
What do we got lined up today? So we have Brian Ouellette. He's a demonologist, and he has been on the show probably about a month ago. He was at Ghost Adventures with Zach, and he did a live exorcism, and we're going to have him back. Brian is just, I love having him as a guest. He's a wealth of information. The guy just knows his stuff. And, he's just a joy to talk to and everything. So he might be on cue. Is he on cue, Jason?
Yeah, let's go ahead and bring him on.
Okay, let's bring him on. We're going to talk about the exorcism and demonology. So we have nothing specific, but that's kind of the avenue we're going to talk about. And we're just going to go into just open discussion.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, how's it going? Good to be back.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
I am doing well. I'm doing well.
Well, thank you for staying up and being our guest. We really enjoy you. And you, like I said, you're just a wealth of information, and we really enjoy having you on the show. So, yeah,
well,
go ahead.
I do appreciate that.
So, anyway, we're going to talk about, demonology, exorcism. And I saw that you were on the show. I watched the show, and I think you and I were kind of messaging each other a little bit during the show that was actually aired. And it was quite interesting. And from my understanding is that after your debut of doing this exorcism, the family has not reported any other problems. Is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, you have to understand one thing that is very difficult, I think, for people to firmly grasp about the nature of demonic possession and demonic oppression. Of course, what you saw in that episode of Exorcism in Erie on Ghost Adventures featured a pretty classic demonic oppression. And so what that involves, when you're dealing with an affliction of that nature, is that there's always going to be emotional and psychological ramifications of these types of interactions, because being demonically attacked is traumatic. It has an effect on our nervous system that is not unlike being attacked by, a human being or being subjected to an act of violence. You know, it's violent to the person's spirit, and there are emotional and psychological effects that linger through that. So, there's always going to be, I firmly stand by this, a need for conventional therapy, even with exorcism, because I think that, you know, a lot of times people have to come to terms with and deal with the trauma that they suffered, particularly if it was a long-term affliction, if it is something that has been with them for a very long time, as would be the case with exorcism and Eerie. The good news is that I have maintained communication with the family, and they are reporting that things are so much better. So that is always good to hear. It's not always the case that performing one blessing or one exorcism is sufficient. A lot of times it takes multiple visits and multiple attempts before such a connection is broken. But we got lucky in Erie, Colorado, and it was a success. I still, of course, in any situation, I would always recommend any client that has gone through what that Chris on the show suffered, that he does seek conventional therapy to deal with some of the emotional scars of the affliction. But that's, that's up to them. That becomes something that they have to seek out. We can usually connect to services if they request a referral. But in most cases, it's something that they take care of on their own. Once the spiritual attachment's broken, then they are free to now heal. And there's a certain amount of grace that is received through the rites of exorcism and the very solemn blessings that we offer to people who are suffering from these types of demonic attacks. And that grace makes room for a healing process. And so conventional therapy is far more effective once they have that grace active and working within their life. So, yeah, that was pretty much a very successful one in terms of breaking the attachment.
Wow.
So I got a question. So now, for the benefit of the listeners, can you break down the different levels of demonic activity? How, you have oppression and possession, and then also for our listeners, kind of go over some things that make people more vulnerable to that kind of paranormal activity?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. It's something that we definitely get asked a lot. And so I think it's important to kind of clarify those terms. There's essentially four primary stages to demonic attack. And very briefly, the first stage is what I would call, and this is not something that you're going to hear a lot of exorcists refer to, but I would call stage one demonic interference. And this is something that every single human being has experienced at some point in their lives. And what that essentially refers to is, the temptations that we experience from day to day to do the wrong thing. Sometimes we just get an inclination to do something wrong. Maybe we just don't feel like doing the right thing that particular day. Or maybe, there's just some personal selfish reason for doing something other than the right thing. And so therefore we make a bad choice. And we maybe hurt somebody's feelings, or we maybe do something that hurts a large group of people. It's, all sorts of things are possible. But this is temptation. This is something that we all experience. Now, sometimes if temptation is left unchecked and a person gets into a pattern of dysfunctional behavior, we'll start to see, certain things develop within them that would lead to a more severe form of demonic interference, where they start to show a type of cynicism. They start losing hope in themselves. They lose hope in humanity. They become negative They become very negative people. And this is an aspect of the demonic. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, that just happens to people. And this is true. But understand that the demonic is not working from a position of authority. The demonic is not working from a position of power. The demonic is actually quite weak, but it's an excellent parasite. And so it lives off of the energy that we give it. In fact, Satan has been robbed. I mean, if you're looking at pure Christian theology here, Satan has been robbed of his authority. Satan has been robbed of his ability to harm creation, with the exception of the permission that we give him, because God has given us the position of custodians of his creation. And so if we give permission through our own error, then that empowers Satan to be able to become more active in our lives and thus by default in the whole world. So demonic interference, even though it doesn't sound terribly serious at first, it actually is very serious, because this is the one that is pretty much the doorway that leads to all the others, and it's usually the one that all of us miss because it is so subtle and it is so natural to us to do the wrong thing. And so human beings are really good at making mistakes. We really are we're experts at making mistakes. And so it's a wonderful doorway to kind of walk in through. It's actually a back door into our lives, and we don't even realize it because it feels so natural to us. We're prone to error, and we know it, and we are flawed creatures. And so Satan uses this to his advantage. So that's stage one. Stage two is more of a traditional insert in demonology, and that is demonic obsession. And demonic obsession is a lot like how it sounds. We see at this point obsessive thoughts. We start to see increasing states of depression. We will often see suicidal ideation at this point, night terrors, nightmares, extreme anxiety, and then eventually a sense of a loss of reality. And that tends to lead into very conventional mental illness. And so a lot of people sometimes ask me, how can you even tell the difference between somebody who is mentally ill and somebody who is demonically obsessed or demonically afflicted in some way? And in the beginning, before we even start a very serious assessment of their spiritual condition, it's very difficult to tell the difference, because they are very much identical. And in a lot of ways, the demonic likes to utilize a person who is vulnerable mentally, because it's a perfect cover. It's a wonderful disguise to kind of hide under a person's mental illness and pretty much be left forever unchecked, because medication really doesn't cure mental illness. It just puts a Band-Aid on it. And in a lot of ways, my background's in psychology. I used to work in a lockdown facility. I worked in clinics, and I can tell you, the mental health field medicates people not to make patients better. It medicates people to make society tolerate them more. It's really for everybody else's sake. It's not really for the sake of the patient, because the medicine's not going to cure them. Xanax is going to make you feel as though you don't have anxiety, but it's not going to cure your anxiety problem. As soon as the Xanax wears off, it's going to come back. And usually it will come back worse, because there's a law of diminishing returns with these types of conditions and medication use. And, you get tolerances that build up and eventually lead to a point where you need to go to stronger and stronger medications. And sometimes people will self-medicate using alcohol or illegal drugs. And so it can be really tricky in the beginning. But one thing that is important to understand is that they always coexist. So if there is a genuine demonic obsession at work, then there will absolutely be a mental manifestation of it that will be in the form of anxiety or depression, usually, or suicidal ideation. But at the stage two of demonic obsession, you are typically going to see only effects that are happening internally. In other words, there's not going to be a lot of externalization of the demonic activity. It's going to be mostly what people are experiencing or feeling, or what the victim is experiencing or feeling, and nobody else can really see it or relate to it because it's all happening on the inside. But it quickly turns into what we call demonic oppression, and that's what we saw on Exorcism in Erie on Ghost Adventures. That is when it starts to involve a physical illness. And then traditional treatments do not work. It is very, very, very common for people that are suffering from demonic oppression to have a medical history where they have been misdiagnosed numerous times. And I can't recall if that was demonstrated on the show or not, but I know that Chris had reported that to me, that he had a lot of misdiagnoses. And, you know, that is something that is a very common thing that we see. It's a big problem because and in a lot of ways it helps us diagnose that the condition is spiritual in nature, because what you're going to see is that people are constantly going for medical help and they keep getting sicker when they should be getting better, when the treatments should be making them better. And these are usually very physical illnesses by this point. By the time it reaches demonic oppression, they are tangible illnesses that doctors can actually diagnose and attempt to treat. But the treatments that should work do not work. And yet prayer makes them better. And that's one of our ways of being able to determine the difference between a demonic oppression or a medical problem. Demonic oppression also tends to manifest in terms of great physical suffering, anger, aggression. They feel angry for no reason at all. They don't even know why they're feeling angry. They will have usually difficulties at work, difficulty maintaining healthy relationships. Usually they're in great social crisis because of this. Because they're, you know, it's starting to affect every aspect of their being by this point. And then stage two also has a third category that we call demonic infestation. And that is not terribly related to people. This is more about objects. But demonic infestation is when there is a possession of an object, an animal, the land or the home that the person lives in. And if left unresolved, it can create the inhabitants of that location demonic obsessions and oppressions, and it can even lead to possession. So that's just something that's worth noting. Yeah, it can be a problem. That's something that we look for. We want to make sure that, you know, if it gets to, you know, if we do identify demonic oppression, a demonic infestation, that we're looking to see if the inhabitants are suffering from oppression or obsession. And then the third category, the third stage of a demonic event would be what we would call demonic possession. And that's the classic that you see in the movies. That is not what you saw on Exorcism in Erie. Chris was not demonically possessed. He was oppressed, and there's a big difference. And usually oppression is a lot easier to resolve. So possession is still relatively rare, but what possession involves is typically the full or partial taking over of the body of the victim, where the demonic entity has some control or all control over that person's function. And it can be a very spectacular to witness. It can be extremely terrifying. What you'll see in these cases are some of the signs and symptoms of possession would be the ability to speak in unknown languages, languages that they did not study at any point in their history. They will have the possession of superhuman strengths. I have seen situations. I've seen cases where, you know, 12-year-old girls have been able to remove five men from holding them down and literally push them up with their arms and everybody fall over. You know, it can be very spectacular and even defy what we would consider to be, you know, ordinary. They also will possess in many ways clairvoyance and clairaudience. They know things about you. They typically will know a lot about the exorcist. In some ways, one of the important things about being an exorcist is to maintain a certain amount of spiritual purity, because they will know your sins. They will know the things that you have done, and they will use them against you as you move and progress through the exorcism. And that's part of that clairvoyance that they possess. There's usually like an absence or darkness in their eyes that can be very disturbing and unsettling. Sometimes it almost appears as if the eyes have no whites at all. It's just a completely dark black eye, as if the whole eye was the pupil. They cannot stomach holy water or religious objects or blessed objects in their immediate vicinity. This usually disturbs them. They will also express extreme physical and mental illnesses as well, and you know, odd and inappropriate behaviors. And the most extreme cases, which are still very rare, you don't see this terribly often, but there will sometimes be levitation, bilocation, the experience of doppelgangers, objects moving by themselves, and even environmental disturbances that would be or resemble an extreme haunting or poltergeist. So that is more rare to see those types of things happen alongside of demonic possession. But that's your three stages and your four primary categories.
So I'm always kind of along the lines of being skeptical, but I think being skeptical is kind of healthy. You know, I'm also not completely oblivious to the fact that there are things in this universe that I don't understand. And but I imagine there's probably a lot of skeptics that might listen and say, well, you know, people can get super strength with surges of adrenaline. You hear about people lifting cars and stuff like that, and stuff like that. I mean, do you think? Has there been cases or evidence that's been recorded that shows a lot of paranormal activity that can't be well refuted during an exorcism?
The thing is that what makes it kind of hard, I think, for conventional researchers to be, have their skepticism resolved. Even for people who are, you know, open-minded enough to say that it's plausible, but they want to see it. They want to see the evidence. The difficulty is, you know, most people that are going through this type of thing do not want to be publicized, do not want to be become a spectacle for the public to witness, you know, their affliction. And so in most cases, exorcisms are kept very quiet and are not talked about publicly, researchers are not invited in. But in a lot of cases, there are doctors present because we want the victims to be safe. They can usually do a lot of harm to themselves or even others in the room during the exorcism itself. So, you know, we try to employ medical staff or anybody that would be able to help us with that side of it, assuming they're willing to help and participate in the spiritual treatment of the victim. And that, you know, they would be able to tell you what they've seen. So it's kind of difficult to say whether or not there's ever been, you know, any kind of formal reports outside of just what the few that have witnessed an actual exorcism have seen, and that's not usually released to the public. Part of the reason why I did Exorcism in Erie, and I was even, you know, called back and I filmed another episode on Ghost Adventures that hasn't aired yet, and why one of the reasons why I am doing this is because, and I've been asked by a lot of producers to, you know, to be on shows, and I've turned people down in the past, and the, one of the reasons why I've decided to do this now is because I want the public to know that there is a place that they can go for help, that there are people who understand this type of thing and know how to treat it. And so I would say better than the evidence of a lot of dramatic paranormal activity taking place during an exorcism, the better proof for me is how instantaneous the cure is when you have a actually demonically afflicted person and you perform a solemn blessing or exorcism on them, and how instantaneously their life changes. And that, I think, is far more spectacular, because being in therapy and being in clinical work and working with extremely mentally ill people, I mean, my patients when I was working in the clinic were almost all of them were either schizophrenic, bipolar, or schizoaffective. And, you know, you just, what you basically did is you just pumped them full of medication and they never got better. They would, in many cases, just continue to get worse. And yet, you know, when a person comes to me now, because I don't do conventional psychology anymore. I see people for the purposes of healing them spiritually. And when they come to me now, more often than not, I'm able to resolve their issue that they've had for years in 1 hour by just performing the proper rites of the church and giving them the grace of God in order to fix the problem. And so that is, I think, far more spectacular evidence that should be researched. So I would like people to see more of that than I would for them to see, you know, the levitations and the rattling of the doors and the smashing of the windows and all of the other, you know, spectacular things that do occur during exorcism. It's far better to see the evidence is in the speedy recovery of the victim. And, you know, you could argue that, well, maybe it's all psychological. Well, you know, you have to understand what is psychological. The very word psyche, where the word psychology comes from, the very word psyche is a derivative, goes back, if you trace its origins, it goes back to the word for spirit. And so there is an intimate connection between the world of the mind and what we call the spiritual world. Now, Carl Jung, the great personality theorist that actually studied under Freud and then eventually, you know, kind of broke away from Freud and developed his own theories on human behavior and personality, understood that the spiritual world and the world of the mind were one and the same thing. They were identical. But we have this idea because of the way that we operate in modern contemporary society is that if it's happening inside your head, then it's not real. The real world's outside of you, and then everything that's inside your head is imaginary because that's where all the unreal stuff happens. And it's actually the other way around. It's the physical world that's not real. We create the physical world out of the elements of our minds, and I can prove that. I mean, look at, I live in Atlanta, so, you know, you can go downtown Atlanta and look at the big skyscrapers and go eat at some of the great restaurants we have in this city and have a wonderful meal, and, you know, maybe, you know, while you're, you know, riding on the tram to get back to your car, you're reading a book that maybe some author wrote. All of this stuff came out of someone's mind. It didn't just show up one day. We had to build it, and we didn't build it by simply saying, "Okay, well, it's time to put a building here." All right, there it is. We had to construct in our minds first the elements that make reality possible. So we don't just think of a story and then it becomes a book. We have to actually write those those words down sentence by sentence to produce a story. We have an architect has to take something out of his mind, his knowledge of mathematics and his imagination to create wonderful works of art to produce a building. And then that has to go down the line to, you know, the people who actually construct it. And that also takes an understanding of taking what was written down out of somebody's mind and then making it real. So the real world, what we call the real world, what we think is the real world, is actually just the fabrications that we created out of the inner reality of our own minds that we tend to think is imaginary. And so when we have an experience that is spiritual, that feels like it's a foreign entity that is trying to invade our consciousness, as it would be for the victim of a demonic attack, particularly one that would be at the level of possession or prepossession. And prepossession is just sort of like such an extreme oppression that they now start to exhibit signs of possession, but they haven't lost, you know, full control yet.
Wow.
And, you know, a person that has gotten to that point feels as though there's a foreign consciousness that's invading their mind and taking over their body. And you know what? That's exactly what it is. That's all it is. A demon is nothing more than an archetypal energy pattern that enters in and overwrites itself onto the pattern of your normal consciousness. That's all it is. Now, you could argue that in very psychological terms, or I should say very psychoanalytical terms, because you have to kind of understand these things in terms of archetypes in order to really understand what's going on here. And that's why I'm so effective at fixing it, because I don't dismiss the psychology. I integrate the psychology into it, because for me, psychology and spirituality are one and the same thing. And so it's not so much about trying to understand why it's all in their head. Now, of course it's all in their head, but that doesn't mean it's not real. Did you watch Harry Potter? You know, I don't know if you saw the Harry Potter films, but the very last one where Harry dies, and remember he meets Dumbledore in that sort of like a train station? And, you know, they have this little discourse, and they're talking about things, and Harry's kind of confused. And he asks Dumbledore, who he knows is dead, but here he is talking to him. He asks Dumbledore, he says, is this real or is it all in my head? And Dumbledore says to him, well, he says, of course it's all in your head, Harry. But why should that mean it's not real? And so that's the problem that will help skeptics to overcome their skepticism and understanding the dynamics of what I call psycho-spiritual synergetic illness. Okay? Is that the way to understand it is that, yes, it is all happening through the person's mind, but that doesn't mean it's not real, and that doesn't mean it's not happening from an externalization or a non-corporeal manifestation that person's mind is resonating with in a very toxic way, and that's what it is. Think of your brain as instead of thinking that all of your thoughts and all of your feelings and everything else are coming from your own mind, instead of looking at it that way, consider that your brain is nothing more than a massive antenna to pick up non-corporeal signals. And so there's all these signals going all over the place, and then when it's functioning normally, then the only signal that it's picking up is you. But when it's being afflicted, if it's vulnerable, if it's weak, then it's going to pick up other signals, less healthy signals. And those signals are truly foreign to our own consciousness, our own faculty of awareness. And that can degrade and be superseded by this foreign energy. And then it overwrites the person's mind. And that's what we call possession. So it's not really true to think of this this invisible monster that's, you know, jumps inside the person's body. That's not demonic possession. That's myth. What is happening in a demonic possession is that there is a non-corporeal energy pattern that is intelligent. It is self-aware. And that can interfere with the normal operations of your mind and reinsert itself into the matrix of your thinking system that you call yourself. And then it becomes, instead of being you, it becomes it. And it takes over your awareness and uses you, and it feels to you like something came in and entered into your body. But it's not how it works. It's more so overwriting your mind, as if you were to take a computer and overwrite it with a virus. And so now the computer doesn't work anymore. And some foreign hacker on the other side of the world can now see all your secret data because he was able to hack into your computer system. Well, a demon is nothing more than a non-corporeal hacker for your brain. And that's the best way that I can describe it. And that's how we fix it, because we fix it through using the rite of exorcism, which is essentially an archetypal antivirus or antiviral removal system. And, kind of using pop culture to explain it.
I've always believed that if demons exist, that, like you're saying, is that we're created them, and I totally am with you on the fact that we create our reality. In fact, that's something that I've been thinking a lot about, that we manifest what comes into our lives consciously or subconsciously. It's like the power of attraction, Dr. Wayne Dyer, and that sort of thing. So I totally am with you on that aspect of it. What do you think, Sherry?
Absolutely. I agree with both of you, and it's amazing how you can describe Brian, the way it's in your experience, it's so different than most people. I would say 90% of the people that think that exorcisms and possession is exactly something takes over you, which when you explain it in a different way, it's perfectly understandable.
Well, Sherry, what's really important to understand about it is that everything is archetypal, okay? And archetypes are essentially the alphabet of our existence. Think of them as the storytellers that make up the stories of our lives. And so, therefore, when we are dealing with demonic or the situation of a demonic attack, whether it be an obsession, an oppression, or possession, or even just the temptation or demonic interference, it has to play out through the vehicle of the story. And this is why every major religion has a mythos that is attached to it. And that becomes the theology of that religion. And this is why all theologies are essentially true, even with the ones that contradict each other, because it is just a way of telling the story of the divine that is completely ineffable. And so we experience things through the stories of our lives. We don't really live in a reality. We live in a construct. And we create stories about who we think we are. And so while our identities are being formed in childhood, we're being conditioned by school, by our parents, even by our own thoughts and feelings, to create an identity based upon all these fabrications. But they're not true identities. You break away all of those aspects and you cease to be you. And that's actually the reality of it, is that we are always nothing more than just the sum of our stories. And so, when you go and you're at a social event, you're having a conversation with somebody, and, usually the first question somebody asks you is, after they know your name, is, what do you do? Because our greatest way of identifying a self in this story that we've created for ourselves is usually our vocation or our career. And so, my story happens to be, I'm a Catholic bishop, I'm an exorcist. That's a story. And I have to play out that story, whether I want to or not, because that's the story that is playing out in my life. But it's still a story. There is no inherent intrinsic reality to it outside of the energy that I've put into it. And so, therefore, it's all a construct. When I die, it's gone, it ceases to be. And honestly, you know, in 100 or 200 or 300 years, no one's going to care. No one's even going to remember that I was even here. And that's the way it's supposed to be, because these are stories. And so when we are understanding our interactions with these higher archetypal systems, like the divine, like spirituality or the theology of a particular religion that may include angels and demons, and these are the characters of its story, we are interacting with that story along the lines of the expectations or canon of that story. It would not make sense if you're reading Harry Potter and all of a sudden, instead of Harry pulling out his wand to fight Voldemort, he decides that he's going to become a stockbroker and he starts, you know, working with Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. You know, that wouldn't make sense. You know, I mean, it would not make sense at all, because it would break the canon. It would, people would read this and be like, what the hell is this? And that is the same for our lives. We have to stay consistent within the story. And so the thing is the reason we have the story is so that we can interact with these divine entanglements in a way that is meaningful to us. And so the way that I would describe this, or correlate this in a way that is easier to understand, is that, you know, I don't know if you played a lot of video games growing up, but, you know, Mario Brothers was a big game. And, you know, Nintendo was big when I was a child. And, you know, everybody had to have Mario Brothers. You know, that was the big thing. Even today, my son, he loves Mario Brothers. He's still playing Mario Brothers. So what is Mario Brothers? Okay, well, you got this little plumber character, and he, you know, he steps on turtles, and he, you know, he tries to attack this, you know, this big bad guy, Bowser. And so you have the archetype of the hero, you have the archetype of the shadow, you have all these Jungian archetypes in play within this storyline that he's in the Mushroom Kingdom and he has to save the princess. You know, it's a very classic archetypal story being played out in a very almost silly cartoonish way. And it's fun, and we like it, and we play it, and it's popular, and Nintendo's made millions and millions of dollars with this. But what is it? What is Mario Brothers? It's nothing more than a binary code of ones and zeros being played out. But that wouldn't be fun if what you saw were the ones and zeros. In fact, that wouldn't even make sense to you. You need a symbolic representation of those ones and zeros to make sense of it. And so those ones and zeros get converted into an image that we can relate to through our sensory systems, and then we can see the story of Mario play out. We get to control him. We're not seeing the ones and zeros anymore. We're seeing what the ones and zeros put together through pixelation. And it's the same thing in this reality. Instead of ones and zeros, we have yin and yang. We have the passive energy, and then we have the passive energy. So you have passive energy, and then you have active energy. Sorry, and that the active principle of yang and the passive energy of yin interact in our lives and produce, voila, human existence. And it's no more than just a Nintendo. It's just a Nintendo video game. That's all it is. But it's on a more intimate level, and it's on a more cosmic scale. So it feels a whole lot more real. But it's still just a story, but it's an important story, because we would not be able to interact with the divine on the divine level. That would have to make that the equivalent to that would be you'd have to be the creator. And what's the creator of a video game? He's the guy who does the coding. He can understand the code. He can write the code. But the player doesn't understand the code. The player doesn't write the code. The player just wants to play the game. And it's no different for us.
Go ahead. I want extra lives and a power up. Please.
Well, see, you're gonna have to go to the creator of the video game to see if he can, you know, write that into your code. And chances are he didn't set that up that way. But you know, there's always reincarnation, and that's a kind of an interesting little aspect. You might be able to use that as a power up.
Brian, can I ask you a question? I saw, and then we're going to go right back to the show, The Ghost Adventure, and I saw at the end, it showed that your eyes were really bloodshot. And I wanted to find out what happened. Was that something that was, like, you know, emotionally, mentally, physically tiring, or was it something that the effect of doing an exorcism?
Well, that's a, you know, I've been asked a lot about that, too. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because there are physical manifestations during exorcisms. And unfortunately, so much was filmed during that episode that a lot of the more interesting things that happened, did not even make it to the final cut. And the audience didn't get to see it. And one of the things that, that happened while I was performing the exorcism is that, and if you recall, it was the object, the horseshoe, and I was, trying to break the connection because we identified that as a cursed object and most likely the power source for the demonic attachment that Chris was suffering from. And so we, I went in and I performed the exorcism on the horseshoe. And while I was doing it, and, you know, the exorcism is actually quite long. You only get to see, like, a few seconds of it, really. It went on for several minutes. And while I was doing it, while I was going through the various stages and going deeper and deeper into the exorcism, there was, like, this spray that was coming up from the horseshoe that was almost like mace. It was getting into my eyes, and it was disrupting my ability to see the words of the page. And this is a very common thing that happens sometimes in exorcisms, is that the demonic entity attempts to affect you in such a way that it forces you to stop the exorcism. Sometimes it will be through extreme nausea, and then all of a sudden you have this intense need to vomit. And so you have to stop the exorcism and run out. Because you don't want to obviously vomit all over the victim, or you don't want to vomit all over the client's house. And so it will stop the exorcism and give the demonic entity a chance to recuperate from the effect of the exorcism that it has on it. And so in this particular case, it wasn't strong enough to do something like that, but it was strong enough to actually spray something into my eyes that made them burn. Like, I mean, it was almost as if somebody put pepper spray on me. And it was very difficult. Yeah, and that's happened to me one time before. So I was familiar with that particular thing. And, my left eye, if I remember correctly, was the one that was very badly affected. And it stayed red, and I had a difficult time seeing out of it for the next 4 days. It took about 4 days to go away. Yeah, yeah.
Do you believe, so Brian, that there are objects that are demonically? I mean, like, let's put it this way: if you were going, as an example, you're going to go to an antique store, or you're going to go to the Goodwill or Salvation Army store. Is your feeling is sometimes that objects are not only imprints, energetic imprints, but do you feel that they can be demonically possessed, and the person can buy it not knowing, and then all kinds of, like, the Hope Diamond and things like that? What do you think about that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Everything, again, remember, think of things in terms of archetypal patterns of energy, okay? Everything's part of the story. And so, you know, there are objects that are spiritually charged with the energy of the people that held them. And so if there was something that was owned by somebody who performed a great deal of satanic ritual or perhaps black magic, or was involved in some type of dark occultism, or maybe they were just a really evil person like, Jeffrey Dahmer, or, you know, somebody that, like, a serial killer, somebody that did horrible, horrendous things to other people. All of that energy has to go somewhere. It gets imprinted into the person's environment and gets contained into their objects. And objects that are used the most, or objects that the person could affiliate with the most, will be the ones that are the most charged. And so, yes, absolutely, there is such a thing as cursed objects. In fact, it's one of the biggest things we look for in our work. Most of the time, it's not a person who is possessed. Most of the time, it's an object. And that was what you saw in Exorcism in the Eerie. I mean, Zach Bagans called me in because he wasn't sure if Chris was possessed. He wanted me to come in to sort of confirm that, but he was fairly certain that he was under a demonic attachment and wanted to help him, wanted to, you know, get him the help that he needed. And fortunately, he was able to call me, and I came in, and we were able to find the source of the issue, which was the horseshoe, and that broke the attachment. So now Chris can heal. It might take him a while to fully feel himself again and get his life back on track, because he's been suffering from this oppression for more than half his life. And that's not going to go away anytime soon, even just because the demonic entity has been released. You know, it's something that he's going to have to live with for a while. But, you know, the thing is that now he can heal, whereas before he was just going to get sicker.
So, and you were, it was a heavy duty thing, because I can see you were, not only did you had to exercise the house, you had to exercise the object and the attachment on the person. So that was a real heavy duty cleansing.
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, actually that one was fairly routine in comparison to some of the other ones that we've done that have been more challenging and more difficult. I mean, you guys got to really see us working at our best, you know, because that was a case that was very easy to identify. It was very easy to diagnose, and it was very easy to break. The hard part is really the victim having to now heal and get and find, you know, the type of conventional help that he needs in order to overcome the trauma of the last, you know, 20 or so years of his life. And hopefully, the, you know, the grace of the church can expedite that for him. It usually does, particularly if he sticks to my regimen. You know, I never leave a victim after an exorcism. I always try to maintain some communication with them or their family, and I give them instructions as to what to do. And in many cases, you know, I tell them, you know, you need to increase your prayer life no less than 2 hours a day. Nobody, whether you are suffering a demonic attack or not, not one of us should be getting through a day without a minimum of 2 hours of prayer. That's really hard for people today because our lives are so busy. But it is essential, because if you want to be at optimal spiritual health, you need to cultivate that relationship with the divine. It is essential. And it doesn't have to be prayer like, you know, kneeling down at your bed and, you know, saying, you know, 20 Hail Marys. It doesn't have to be that kind of prayer. You know, it can be meditation. It can be quiet time. In fact, I would encourage centering prayer, you know, just listening to God, waiting to see what he tells you, because, you know, we're usually so noisy when we're praying that we don't have time to even hear him. And sometimes the best prayer is the prayer that is left unsaid. And so just taking the time to spend with God, getting connected to the sacraments of the church, if Christianity is your religious proclivity, and you know, getting baptized, you know, that's a big one. All of these things, the sacraments, all of these things help to increase that grace and to further heal a person and prevent them from being attacked again in the future to that degree. We're all going to get attacked. That's guaranteed. But being spiritually strong is what prevents us from, you know, what separates those that get, you know, demonically possessed and those that go on and live normal lives.
Can it be, Brian, can it be like 2 hours, like 1 hour here or 1 hour there or half an hour here? Or do you say that it should be like 2 straight hours? I mean, really spend the time. It's a matter of priorities, just like, I mean, that's how I feel. How important is it for you to have your connection with the divine?
I think, you know, it doesn't have to be 2 hours at a time. It can definitely be, you know, 45-minute slots. You know, or 30-minute slots here and there. I mean, that's fine. I think it's important. And I tell people, you know, it's important to try to get 8 to 9 hours of sleep. Sometimes even 10 is even better. And then if you can, you know, it's hard because our jobs and our lives are stressful, particularly here in America where we're just workaholics. But you know, getting up maybe a half hour earlier, and then instead of just like rushing to the coffee machine or rushing into the shower or whatever it is that, you know, you do in the morning, take that 30 minutes to just sit there in the presence and bask in the presence of God. you know, and then instead of going to bed, getting tired and going right to bed, instead of doing that, you know, take an extra half hour, go to bed a half hour earlier, and then spend 30 minutes just basking in God. So there's already an hour. And then if you can find the time to do, you know, a half hour, sometime in the middle of the day and maybe another half hour at some point, you know, then that's great. It's hard with family life and everything else. If you've got kids, it's really hard. You know, I get that. But the thing is it's important to try to – you have to have some benchmark to work towards, even if you can't hit it perfectly every day. It's more important that you're trying to hit it and that you're doing everything that you can to cultivate that relationship. But, no, it doesn't have to be 2 hours straight.
Well, Brian, I'm just glanced down at the clock, and we only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to make sure to give everyone an opportunity. If they want to, I mean, do you let people contact you if they have questions, or is there a website? I don't remember if they want to reach you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to reach me, actually. You can go to esotericcatholic.org. That's esotericcatholic.org. That's the church's website. If you live in the Atlanta, Georgia area and you feel that you're having some kind of paranormal disturbance in your home or in your life that you would like us to evaluate, we've got a lot of cases. I'm not going to lie to you. We have more cases coming in than we're able to actually get to. But we do call everybody. We do at least make contact with everybody. And we are right now taking the most serious of cases. But, you know, if there's one that we can squeeze in, we try to do everything that we can. So you can go to the Order of Exorcists link on that website and request an investigation. There's also a contact us there. You can find me on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/exorcistbishop, and that will take you to my public Facebook page. I'm also on Twitter at Eye of the Seer. That's all one word, Eye of the Seer. You can find me there. Got a lot of Twitter followers over there, and they ask me questions every day, and I try to answer all of them. I'd like to be as approachable as I can. I have a lot of work, but you know, I try to always take time to reach out and answer questions if I can.
Brian, I want to help you with this, and you know, now that we are on public radio, also too, on two radio stations, FM stations. I want to help you by. I want you to see, tell them about your new platform that you are offering for people, the Esoteric Platform, and anybody would be interested in that.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, we're starting a seminar series. A lot of people on Twitter found me after Ghost Adventures, and, you know, we get into some really deep philosophical conversations, and I'm not just an exorcist, you know, I'm not just a Catholic bishop, but I'm also a metaphysician and an esotericist. I've studied the occult the majority of my life, and there's a great wealth of information that can be learned from this through a safe exploration of it. I'm relatively safe. I mean, you know, anytime you're dealing with high-level spirituality, there's some risk involved in that, but you can minimize those risks. And so if you're interested in taking my seminar series, we think we've got it priced right now at $9.99 a week. Is what we're asking. It's going to be a weekly class that's going to probably run about an hour and a half to 2 hours each week. It's going to be at least 100 lectures. But when you consider you break it down, it's still a lot less than taking a college course. And you're getting a whole lot more material and a lot more lecture time and personal time with me. It's online. It will be archived. So if you miss a class, you'll be able to watch it on demand. At your leisure. We're getting that platform set up now, actually, and we're hoping to get it live sometime early in June, so hopefully within the next week or two. But there's an early registration form, a pre-registration form at esotericcatholic.org/seminars, or you can just go there to esotericcatholic.org and click on seminars, and you can kind of sign up there. And the only thing I ask is that, you stay on. If you do want to take the course, commit to the course. It's all going to the charity of our ministry. So, you know, no one's getting rich off of this. Some people have said $9.99, that's way too expensive. And other people have said, you're underselling yourself. I'm going to buy two subscriptions because I want your ministry to succeed. And it's really, it's to help the ministry. We do not have anywhere near enough resources coming in to be able to help all the people who need it. And that's part of the reason why we're having to turn cases away, because we just don't have the financial resources to do more. And this is a way of hoping to finance the ministry, to get an external office here in Atlanta that we can start seeing people in bulk numbers. And so if you want to help us with that, I can help you to really develop your spirituality. So go to esotericcatholic.org, click on seminars and sign up. And we really could use your support, and you're really going to like these classes. They're really going to be fascinating.
Awesome. Well, we are out of time. Brian, I want to thank you again for taking the time to come on the show once again. And it's been very entertaining as usual and informative, and hopefully we can get you back on in the future once again.
It'll be my pleasure anytime. Just let me know.
Thank you, Brian. And you, Brian also has his own radio show, so.
I sure do. You can find that on
my website. I listen to your radio show.
I appreciate
that. We're all in it together, and I'll help
that.
Each other out. That's great.
Thank you so much.
All righty.
Hey. Next week we're gonna have open lines. So Jason and I are just gonna shoot the breeze, and if anybody has any one question pertaining to them, don't ask questions for other people. But if you have a question for yourself, I'd be happy to do a psychic reading. So love to give back, and you know, like I said, we're all in it together. We're all here to share, learn, love, grow, and that's what it's all about. So okay. Jason.
Yes, and I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and thank our guests for coming on, and all the listeners, not only on Blog Talk Radio, but 106.5 KITC FM and 107.1 KNCP in Central Oregon. And with that, we will see everybody next Sunday at 8 p.m. for Open Lines. And unless you have anything else, Sherry, we'll call her quits.
Don't have anything else to say but tell everybody thank you for supporting Paranormal Horizons and supporting KITC and KNCP FM. So, well, until next week, peace.
Good night, everyone.
Take care. Bye-bye.